Und herzlich willkommen zu Signals from the Future, powered by Waterkant. Wie kann Demokratie mit den Herausforderungen des 21. Jahrhunderts Schritt halten? Internationale Stimmen aus Skandinavien und Deutschland diskutieren über das Ende der Blackbox-Politik und darüber, dass wir mehr Transparenz und echte Mitsprache schon im Alltag brauchen. Mit dabei sind Erde Movacic, Lene Hartig-Danielsen und moderiert wird das Ganze von Wolfgang Schmidt. Der Talk wurde aufgenommen auf dem Waterkant Festival 2025. Wenn du mehr solcher Inhalte möchtest, dann folg uns doch auf Social Media und komm am besten zum Waterkant Festival 2026. Viel Spaß!
So hope everybody's awake now. Sun is shining, sparkling on the waves, seagulls circling above our heads. So I would call this an uplifting scenario. We are ready to set sail here at Innovation Stage, second day of the festival, and we will dive right into the futures and with nothing less than a very big question to be answered, and that is, how can democracy catch up with the demands of the 21st century? Our world is shifting fast, and we apparently need more than just a minor course correction, and that is why we have this amazing panel up here. Wolfgang to my right. So, those of you who came by Sprottenflotte bike this morning, I don't know whether anybody is in the audience, you have already been in touch with Adam this morning. So it's not only about theory, I can tell. And apart from Adam, who will tell us a little more about the next democracy, apparently, there are two experts who will share their perspectives of the cities in the north. And one of them is your host for the very first session, and that is Wolfgang Schmidt. He is head of international affairs for the city of Kiel and a key figure in the Baltic City Networks. So with his deep experience in regional cooperation, he will share his insight on how cities are some sort of living hub for democratic innovation. And I wish you lots of fun. So a big Waterkant welcome to this amazing panel. And over to you, Wolfgang.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for your nice words. It's the first time that one is calling me before 12 o'clock amazing. So I'm part of this amazing group here. Let's see who's the most amazing one. I guess one of them, but we will see. Maybe we'll make a poll afterwards who was the super amazing guy on this stage. As already said, my name is Wolfgang, and I'm the chairman of the UBC Smart and Prospering Cities Commission, together with my dear friend and colleague Christian from Aarhus. UBC, Union of Baltic Cities, is an alliance of more than 70 cities around the Baltic Sea region. What we want to do is to learn from each other. We want to raise visibility for this very special, super unique and really impressive region in the world first. And we want to do lobby work. So we as Kiel alone, as Aarhus alone, we are much too small when it comes to the big questions they do in the EU, when it comes to money, when it comes to transformation, whatever. So this is what UBC is doing. And we see in these times that it's very, very, very important to talk about democracy. If you look at what in the US is happening, if you look at what is happening in Germany with the far right coming up, Denmark, of course, and not at least, and this is where I look at my dear friend Vitaly, who's the deputy mayor of Kherson, and this is where we really say democracy and life is really under fire. So it's not only something we talk about, but it's literally that people every day die because they do something for our democracy. They're last line standing between us and a totalitarian state. Today we would like to raise the question together with two amazing, we don't know who's the most amazing one, Adam, maybe you will be, we will see. We will have two speakers here today. One is Lene, my dear friend Lene from Aarhus, who's responsible for the Borger service there. So not only a service to the people, but also a very important part of democracy in Aarhus in Denmark. And we have Adam. Adam, yes, Adam, how shall we introduce you? Adam started out at McKinsey. Then he did some very important work in the machinery room, so to say, of capitalism. Then he founded Donkey Bike, and therefore the question was super good, who took the Sportenflotte, because this is run by Donkey Bike. And at any point, Adam, you told me that McKinsey didn't inspire you anymore. You gave up the Donkey Bike thing and started to talk about democracy. And this is where we came in. We had a fantastic night out in Copenhagen with 2.5 hours talk and maybe 15 bottles of beer, I guess. We should count them again. And it was so fantastic that we said, we have to have Adam in, and he has brought his new book, The Next Democracy, with him. So, Lene, maybe you want to start with your presentation and tell us about... Yeah, or do you want... No, we had Adam first. Sorry, Adam, you always have to... If I change things, you just have to cry. Too early, we start with Adam and his new book, The Next Democracy. And he told me that all of you will get a special prize if you pay it today. Adam, is that right, or did I get this wrong?
Thanks, Wolfgang. It's so nice to be here. I love this format. Thanks for having me. My name is Adam, Turkish name. I'm now living 18 years or so in Denmark. I've been a social entrepreneur. I want to call myself a social entrepreneur. Tried to work with kind of innovating state or doing impact business. Donkey Republic City Bikes, the first bike share where you could get a bike on an app, was one of those things. But I wrote this book, I started actually 6 years ago, with the understanding that businesses can't do it alone. And impact business or impact investment, investors can't do it alone. The conscious consumers can't do it. That the society that we need to build has to come from renewing or building a strong social contract. We can discuss why the consumerism part or the investor part can't make it. And then I tried to work with Innovating Democracy back in 2010 when there was early days of internet. There was a lot of hype around how internet will make democracy stronger and citizens closer to decisions. I got very inspired by powerful people at the time in different conferences, one of them Julian Assange, actually. With this book, I'm trying to say that we need to rethink how we organize ourselves, how we organize our collective decision system, that we need to really think out of the box. Unlike the tech bros in the US, I don't think creating a sort of tech universe where the citizens don't have agency and we give the right to make decisions into a black box of an AI, I don't think that's the way to go. But we need to really use the tech tools to redefine how we want to govern ourselves. And that also, some of the core ideas in the book is to, I call it merit democracy. How do we bring numbers and analysis and also decentralization of decision making into the core, which basically says, can we let go of representation? And how do we then make sure that decisions are of quality and we make them with agility, at the same time with full transparency, and finally, that you can redefine your agency? If we should dig into the problems of democracy today, and Wolfgang, I don't know how long I should talk about this because it can be the full 45 minutes. But one of the... You just give me a hint, okay?
Yeah, I will.
Okay. So one of the, I think, problems with democracy, one of the obvious ones is the decreasing trust in our institutions. It's the decrease of trust in democratic institutions are not only in the US, but also in Scandinavia, even in Denmark. And recently, for example, Danish government asked the schools not to debate the issue of Palestine. And there are other things that you could point at. But across the Western world, we have also a cost of living crisis. We have mental health crisis, obesity crisis. And these are more local issues. So if we talk about climate, you could say it's a global issue. You know, the Chinese and the US doesn't want to work with us. But if we talk about the local issues, then our democracies should really do the job. And they're not, the institutions are not living up to the job. And I don't think it's to blame any individuals. It's to blame the system. I think well-educated, well-intended people in politics cannot function within this system. It has... very limited time. They have very limited time to actually debate and look deeply into the issues. There's a lot of lobbyism. There's a lot of media attention that puts them on the sort of the firefighting role. Whereas we don't have a good way of bringing in the knowledge that are in the within us, the citizens. And the companies, we don't engage companies in a good way to create goods for society. So I think we can do much better job in doing that. So the core ideas in the book is about decentralization. How can we learn from capitalism? Capitalism, compared to what the Soviet Union, I guess, tried to do, is decentralizing financial decisions. And imagine today, you probably have, hopefully, some stocks, and you know how they are performing, and you can move them around easily. And compared to that, to how you are investing your public funding that you're contributing, or we all share, is going through some decision makers, and you never know what the return of that is. So there's a whole different way of interacting when we are investing our capital versus our citizen capital. We are acting with stories, and we don't have numbers to back what those stories are actually delivering and are about. So I think we need to be inspired by success of capitalism and use the kind of transparency and data framework and decentralization. And then tech companies. Tech companies have taken over. The car industry in Germany is suffering against the American or Chinese, if you like. And the core of the tech is fast learning loops. So how can you wire whatever you're doing, whether it's a car company or a media company or a hotel network, whatever it is, and in my case, the Donkey Republic, the bike share, you can harvest a lot of data if you want to and link a lot of your decisions and even make iterative learning loops. So it's about how cheap and how fast you can learn to make better decisions. Now, if you learn faster, you will do a better job. And at the end, that's how they win and have the power they have. So instead of putting the finger on tech companies for making life so much harder for our democracies, it's not their job to work for, social responsibility and so on. All companies have to work for their bottom line. And they will do so as an externality, creating addictions. YouTube does that, yes. But it's their business to make sure that people watch more YouTube. What, on the other hand, we need to do is to learn how to regulate better and faster and do this iterative learning loop using the data to understand what regulations are creating. So, for example, GDPR, great intentions, but have we learned fast enough if it worked in protecting our data and what was the cost of that to SMEs, and can we iterate that? Maybe already after 6 months that we have implemented it and iterated many more times since. So that's not happening in the policy space. So two things that the book is really about: rethinking institutions without representation, but using data and decentralization in how we do both public policy and public service. It's quite ambitious. I hope you like that little summary, and I guess we'll debate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you. It is ambitious and interesting. So do you allow questions from the audience? Do you allow to challenge you with your ideas?
Obviously.
Do I see questions here in our auditorium?
Maybe we should mention, Wolfgang, we have this fishbowl session after.
Yeah, absolutely, you're right. So there will, if you don't want to ask now, we will go on at 11 o'clock with a more intense discussion where we'll have Vitaly in and Maureen from San Francisco too, so where we can discuss a bit deeper. But Lene, maybe also, you want to...
You can also be bored. So WaterKant is all about being bored and just asking questions. So yeah. Feel free, just fire away.
It's always hard with the first question, Lene. Maybe do you? What do you think about this idea? Would this work in Aarhus in Denmark?
Thank you for being here. It's a privilege. It's my fourth time to visit this festival, and I'm very flattered to get the new invitation. And thank you for your speech and discussion. I think I'll share with you in a little bit what my perspective is on democracy from a very practical perspective and approach due to experience. I haven't written a book, but worked in the public sector for almost 30 years. So I claim I have some kind of experience to rethink how democracy works in a municipality and at a national level. I'll share with you. One thing I noticed was that you mentioned, Adam, that regulation is going too slow. I'm not sure I agree on that. Actually, the approach in Denmark from the citizens' perspective and from the local government's perspective is that regulation and legislation is going too fast, and it's not done properly with the perspective from a practical everyday life that need to be changed, and regulation is not always the proper answer. Practice is the proper answer. So I just reflected a bit on that.
Adam, do you want to answer on that?
We could wait.
There is a question now, so I would just jump in, right? So,
what I would be interested in, you also give an answer, how do we teach politicians and people like myself working in a city how to do this, how to analyze this data, how to understand the data, and how to work with this? Because I think this is a huge challenge in democracy, that how do we teach or give even children the experience what democracy is to make then decisions, and how do we do this on data? Because I think, okay, I work in more on digitalizing things, that the data competence in most countries is very low. So I think that from a perspective, it's quite interesting, but who should teach and help us understand this?
All right, so first of all, we have a 4-yearly election process where politicians' main job is to get re-elected, and that the main incentive. And of course, what they deliver is affecting what happens, but often what they deliver has a long lifetime. So it might be that the politics of what has been done before you affects actually the period that you're in. And we don't measure, we don't isolate or measure the policies impacts that you have installed. So even if we did measure, politicians don't want these numbers to be out in public, because what if they these things that they argued for did not deliver the results they want to show? We don't have a system that incentivizes politicians to come out there with numbers and analysis. We have a system where they want to be popular, and for that they are actually quite diligent using surveys to make sure that the arguments they are making and the framing they are using is relatively popular. So we are constantly told stories to make us want to believe that this politician understands us and is in the direction. So they use numbers in trying to make the right argument that will get them the vote, and not solving the problems, especially not within the short period they have in the office. So my quick answer is they would use the data to run policy agenda and services if that was their actual need to gain or maintain power. It's not. So we need to change the structure of the 4-yearly election, or that you get voted on based on your popularity, not your score of how well your policies solved the issues. And I think it's a training or capacity building problem. Thank you.
It's of course you can question political governance, but I think one of the obligations you have as a civil servant and the service who are serving the people and the government have an obligation to provide the political system with the decent data. In the city of Aarhus, we, a couple of years ago, adapted a framework, and I think we're working on that still, but it's being implemented. Instead of now, today, working with the so-called critical problems we acknowledge exist, like climate crisis, democracy, etc., we now work in the framework of what we call the Aarhus Compass. And it has three elements, and it's been published as an audiobook as well in English, so you can just listen to it if you want to. It has three elements. It says good policy, good decisions should be made on the basis of data. It should contribute with value to the citizens, and it should be performed in cooperation with the civic society. And I think that's, I mean, the initial initiative maybe a decade ago was the citizenship policy, and today you're actually implementing, you know, city council decisions in this, within this framework. And I think it works. So that could be an advice, maybe, or an inspiration for working in another way. But data is definitely part of the decision making in our city council.
So can I just add to this? The OECD report looking into why there's public trust erosion in democratic institutions, they basically say the more the authorities show they are acting based on data, the more trust they build. The more the framework of decision is transparent and what the data shows, the more trust they build. But the trust is decreasing. So there's maybe the perception in public that the data and the reality is not driving the politics. There is about $8 million spent on each lobbyist in Washington, and a similar number actually in Brussels. So we have a lot of pressure, and a politician's life is a meeting to a meeting to another meeting and memos coming around, and their bros, they're the people they work with most, and the ex-politicians are these lobbyists that they are constantly meeting, and that's probably the providers of their next job. So I think we have a very hard time acting on, let's say, impartial data versus the interest groups that sort of hijack the political agenda. And then back to your question about, you know, we are not regulating or we are over-regulating. I mean, we have this huge mental health crisis with the young people, and we could see that with social media and you know, smartphone adoption, it's been a problem of last 15 years. Where has been the regulatory agenda on that? There's also an issue with obesity and the food and how we are, from schools to what we are selling in terms of sugar and butter tax. We haven't been at all progressive enough in terms of regulating also tech. So I think we can do much faster regulation and then iterate on the regulation we've done. Housing crisis. I mean, when people graduate now, the young people, they have to pay a lot more to get into the housing market than it was the 30 years or 50 years ago. Again, regulation is failing, inequality is increasing similarly.
But maybe just a quick reply. Maybe there's the appropriate response is not always regulation in a traditional way. Maybe it's another behavior or attitude, which is part of democracy as well. Because democracy is not only about institutions, it's also how we live our lives.
Can I say a word on that, or should we wait?
Maybe we, if you allow, we have one question from the audience.
The fire is on, anyways.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think you talk on a very high level of politicians, talking Berlin and Washington. I'm a politician. I'm elected in a very small country in the vicinity of Kiel. And I think that is democracy. There, really, democracy is happening. And obviously, what I would love to have is an administration where we have a dialogue. Because at the moment, I see that our administration, in a very small amt, is not having the data. We do not have the data. And therefore, we are struggling to make decisions. And I think that has to be happening. And then we are talking democracy at the base. And then we have an impact on Berlin or other, or Kiel or Schleswig-Holstein. And I think that is so important. I don't believe at all that you can regulate housing crisis or obesity with regulation, because that would mean we forbid this food, we forbid soft drinks, we will solve housing via a central regulation from Berlin, who gets a house and who doesn't, and how much to pay. And I think it's just not possible. So I believe more in this behavior thing and the basis of democracy.
Thank you, Simone. Many, we should add that Simone has been CFO of Lufthansa, so Adam, she knows a bit how to deal with numbers and how to steer by numbers, and now as a politician and one must say important person here in our city, because she brings art to the city with her gallery. Before we come to Lena, to your presentation, maybe I should explain why I'm a bit overdressed today. So my wife today in the morning, she saw a picture of Adam, and she told me, "Look like this startup, young startup entrepreneur, and now I had a look at your fantastic New Balance shoes, Lena. I must prove her right." So she said, "Please, maybe you can wear a super black shirt or something like that." The thing is that the U.S. ambassador to Germany asked me today in the afternoon to meet him over a cup of coffee. And that was the point where my wife said, "Okay, you have to wear a black suit." And I said, "Okay, I have to be somewhere in the middle. This is why I wear a black jacket now today and a white trouser, more or less white trouser, and those shoes here. Next time, Adam, I will exactly look like you. Exactly." Lena, sister city of Kiel is Aarhus. Christian is from Aarhus, from the mayor's office, is the deputy chairman of the UBC Smart and Prospering Cities Commission. We have a long-standing sister city partnership, a good cooperation between those important hubs in the north here. And we are super happy to have you for the first time here, fourth time in Kiel. Next time, maybe you become a Kielerin. We can talk to the mayor. Maybe you can become a citizen of our city. But first, your presentation. Looking super forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a privilege. You look fantastic, doesn't it? Anyway, thank you very much. I'd like to share, I don't have all the solutions, but I'd like to share with you some of the reflections, the approaches, and the experience we have from the city of Aarhus, which is also the city of Smile. I'm an optimist. And I think that's an attitude we have to work with. I mean, I'm also a realist. I know and acknowledge the climate crisis, all kind of international crises. Of course, I'm fully aware of them. But I think we have to listen, read data, reflect on data, and rethink maybe how we live our lives in local municipalities can actually enhance trust and cooperation with the citizens whom we're here for. Whatever we are, politicians, like some of you are, or we're civil servants, or just engaged citizens in our city. So I think the way we live is part of democracy. It's not just about elections and about institutions. It's the way we live our lives, everyday lives. Because there are more everyday lives than there are election days, right? However, let me show and share with you some perspectives, and we might have a discussion afterwards. I think one of the key words is trust. How can we reflect on trust? And what is trust actually? How, when you look at the person who's sitting next to you, would you trust someone? It's about trust in institutions, in policy and politicians, which is not the same, in processes, and last but not least, in fellow citizens. I think the fourth is quite important. In general, in Denmark, people have high confidence and trust in political institutions. All surveys show that. Whatever it's the government as such, the parliament, the judge, the judicial system, or the people who are serving the government. And of course, we have the checks and balances to make sure that we're not exceeding powers within the constitution. We also made an additional, so to speak, local survey in the city of Aarhus, which came out with some results that I, you know, basically want to share with you. And it confirms, unfortunately, that, but we have to reflect on that, that the data says that trust in politicians is not very high, in processes is mixed, depending on what your what is your errand at towards the municipality. And the fellow citizens' trust degree is quite high. I think that's data to reflect on when you, you know, are going to make new initiatives to the benefit of the city and the citizens. What we also know from the survey, the local survey, that to be in contact with another person, like we're here today, that contributes to trust and confidence among people. Satisfaction with decisions and service also contribute to trust. Democratic self-confidence and participation also, you know, contribute to trust in decisions and processes. And information and transparency, of course, is a contribution to the element of trust. Let me share with you some of the examples I know from my everyday life during a lot of examples. And these are all examples that's not just theory or mindsets or written on a paper. That's important too, but they're really everyday life examples that can be practiced. I think if you have the courage in every city. But let me start with the most predictable, I think, trustworthy thing we have in this in our country, which is the election day, basically. What characterized the elections in Denmark is they're really, really high trusted due to the Danish election integrity is among the highest in the whole world. UN ranking lists show that, I think, for the fourth or maybe the third or fourth time, Denmark is number one on the list. And that might, that data makes us reflect on why are we there? I think especially in insecure times like democracy is challenged, democracy is on fire, this predictability that characterizes our election scheme, so to speak, is quite important. It's well known by the citizens. It's quite easy to participate in democracy in Denmark. You're automatically on a voters list. You automatically, you can. It doesn't require that much, to, you know, to be a candidate for the local municipality. So there's, an, so to speak, an easy access to democracy on election day. I think we have less than 2 kilometers to the nearest polling station in our city. So this kind of accessibility also means something. We try to support it with social initiatives, you know, to enhance the participation, and the turnover in elections is quite high. Let me show you some more pictures from everyday life. Some of the people that have maybe have less trust in democracy, maybe the deprived people, the less educated people, how can we actually facilitate initiatives so they feel they're part of a community? And that's one of the initiatives we work with in the deprived neighborhood, where we didn't, you know, told them what to do, but we facilitated the initiatives they wanted to do to enhance their feeling and everyday life of democracy. All these people being in the municipal hall here is not administrative staff. In Denmark, we trust each other the election day. They're only like Christian, one secretary or maybe two at the polling station, but the rest are just, so to speak, ordinary people. Isn't it fantastic that we trust each other election day? And it's predicted that it's ordinary people we trust. We don't even know them. But we get to know each other on election day, don't we? We complete strangers when we meet in at 7 o'clock. But when we finished after midnight, we're best friends. So that's a way to work with it. Another initiative we have tried to carry out is Citizens Proposal. It's a trial which started out a couple of years ago, where a citizen can actually upload a proposal to, you know, where you cooperate with the city council. And the city council is obliged to discuss the proposal from the citizen if he or she can count and gather 1,500 votes. That's quite difficult, as shown. But I mean, this is a trial. We try it out, and maybe we'll lower the gathering of votes after this year. And then it can be discussed in the city council and it can be approved or rejected. And people actually use this opportunity. And you know, the diversity in the different proposals are quite wide. Here's a question of climate. There's a question of benches to lay on. There's a speed limit suggestion. All kind of initiatives from the citizens. And of course, we have a digital platform where we perform this kind of initiatives. However, the citizens can always attend the counter or call the citizen service to get help if it's needed, also to this kind of initiatives. Participatory budgeting is another initiative we have. Here we actually both give the competence and the money to the citizens. They have to be engaged in the, that's one of the terms, they have to be engaged in their municipality. And they upload their proposal, they verify the proposal. So it's actually democracy in two steps. And the citizens allocate the budget. And they also have the responsibility for the implementation. So here, the city council and the administration actually leave the powers to the citizens. And also these are just concrete examples where, again, people meet people in the everyday neighborhood. Maybe they don't know each other before they met, but we can actually facilitate the, so to speak, the democratic atmosphere within the municipality and the city with an initiative like this. One of the latest and most funny, interesting, engaged initiatives we have done lately is part of an Urbact EU project. Actually, up to when it comes to election day, municipal elections or political discussions, it's quite often the political parties that actually take the initiative to discuss with the citizens, right? They arrange the topics, they pick the venue, they, you know, they set the scenes. But with this initiative, we actually tried to make these inverse voter meetings. And what does that mean? That means that we, from different kind of neighborhoods within the city, have actually given competence to maybe, I think, 25 now citizens. They arrange their own voter meetings. They pick the venue. Put the agenda, they invite the politicians, not the opposite around. And it's quite interesting. We just did some interviews with the, you know, the engaged citizens on this. And it definitely, data shows, it enhances their trust, not only in policy, but also in politicians. And that data is quite interesting. So the next step will be, how can we, you know, replicate this initiative maybe in other areas. And they put up different kind of topics, you can see. Actually, I participated myself, where you see the barrel. And the first question the youngster that arranged this meeting said, you have to spray democracy on the barrel. So you can express yourself in different kind of ways. I think even we have sent one to Kiel. This is the participation boot or phone. How many of you have been to a voters or a political meeting? Yeah, not so many. Quite often people don't have time, or we don't have the courage maybe to raise our hand and raise our voice and have an opinion. So if you want to develop an area, if you want to adapt or develop a policy, maybe you should lower the barrier for participation. And that's what this initiative is actually aiming. We put this in a basement in a housing project where when you're waiting for the washing machine to finish, you could actually grab the telephone booth and raise your voice on a topic. And this is just an ordinary neighborhood where we don't have any electricity, we don't bring it. But of course the house and the local municipalities provided us with the electricity due to, you know, the coherence in the local community. So we collect the voices and they're transcribed. And they can you can vote for them or you can just, you know, reflect on them. But they're qualitative data in the policy process, right? And everyone has a voice, right? In some way or another. And then one of the last initiatives I'll mention, and we've had that almost for a decade, is what I call red tape meetings. For ordinary people, it can be quite tough to meet municipality, the system. And again, how can we lower the barrier for a dialogue with the municipality? So we set up these meetings for different kind of, so to speak, target groups, the very life experienced senior citizens, the youngsters, the international, and the deprived citizens, so to speak. And it's not that we put people into boxes, but we have to have a framework to work within. And they create the agenda. I'm not creating the agenda. They set up the agenda. What is important for the citizens to discuss with the administration is on the agenda. It's not dangerous, it's great fun. And it's not the same as citizen service can solve all the challenges or problems or topics they put on the agenda. But maybe we know someone who can elaborate a bit, maybe a politician, maybe someone from the administration, can elaborate a bit on the topic they have on mind, or maybe we can change a practice by listening, etc. So this data input is quite important. I'm finishing up, Wolfgang. The last example I'll mention is Denmark is a very, very digital country when you come to the public sector. However, we know, and to most of us, it makes great sense. We have access to the public sector 24 hours and every day. However, we also know that some people are not, maybe someone who has not need the public sector the most, actually are deprived from using digital solutions. And to address that, we made a plan for digital inclusion, where we again try to listen to the citizens that are not able to attend the digital service. How can we actually improve our attitude or maybe our service in other ways? If I should sum up, I think we should still find the balance. My take on this is really a question of trust, reflection, thought, but also of actions. I'm not disillusionated about the future, and I think if we are that, we might just as well go home. We have to fight. We have to have a positive attitude. We have to co-create, and we have to work together, not just with the institutions and the politicians, but also together among people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Lena. Have you recognized that Lena has eyes in the back of her head? So she can see if I jump out on the chair, she has seen that. So this is real expertise, I would say. I thank the both of you. I thank you, Lena, and I thank you, Adam. I thank all of you. And the Waterkant management has forced me to thank our sponsors. Initially, they wanted me to tattoo every single logo on my left arm, but I said, this is not what I'm paid for. So I only got the Rewe logo on the left arm. So we have 15 minutes break. We meet again at 11 o'clock because we go on with the session in a different format. In a bowl format where we can have a deeper discussion and where I would like to bring in our friends from San Francisco and Kherson and, of course, our lecturers here to go deeper into this question. Adam.
Do I get to respond to the point about behavior and all? I think there's so much to talk about here, but short said, behavior change without the contract cannot really work. We need to let go of this impression that through our, I mean, there's four economic hats we have. We are laborers, we are consumers, we are investors, and then we are citizens. Now we ask people to change their day-to-day, meaning the work they do, maybe the investments they do, and maybe the consumption they do. And it's insufficient if we don't have the proper state-building approach. And everything that you mentioned, Lena, I think is fantastic. I think it's not going fast enough and deep enough. So for all the citizen participation and panels, those decisions are not trickling, or those inputs are not trickling to decisions. I would say it's a lot of greenwashing on the politician side. It's better than doing nothing, but we need to do a lot more. So what Daniel Schmachtenberger calls for is a Manhattan Project-like project to innovate democracy, where I would say we're doing a whole military build-up, and now we should spend 5% of our GDP on this. Great. We should, I think, spend at least 1% of our GDP, probably more, in rebuilding democracy and testing out things that you've put on the screen, and where we actually figure out, does this work better, does that work better, not only in building trust, but also the outcomes that we want. So people should be feeling and seeing themselves more in charge, but we can test out different processes where we see, are the outcomes good? Are we agile enough in making the collective decisions? So we have a lot of room to cover, and I think if we dig our head to the sand and say, we're doing something on this front, then we might end up like a little US, also in Denmark. So thank you.
I thank you, Adam, and we will have, I say one more, yeah. We will have the opportunity to discuss all this at 11 o'clock on the dock stage. So 50 minutes time for you to have a cup of coffee, 50 minutes time for me to change my clothes, and we meet again at 11 o'clock at the dock stage. Thank you.
And again, a huge thank you for taking us to this tiny little trip to Denmark. So it was super interesting. As you heard, if you want to dive a little deeper, meet them at the dock station. Thank you for your participation.